10 ways to be purpose-driven. 1. Assimilate new members on purpose. Use the circles of commitment as your strategy for assimilating people into the life of your church. Begin by moving the unchurched from the community to your crowd for worship. Then move them from the crowd into the congregation for fellowship. Next, move them from your congregation into the committed for discipleship, and from the committed into the core for ministry. Finally, move the core back out into the community for evangelism. This process fulfills all 5 purposes of the church. Notice that I suggest you grow the church from the outside in rather from the inside out. Start with your community, not your core. This is opposite the advice given by most books on church planting. The traditional approach to beginning a new church is to build a committed core of mature believers first, then start reaching out to the community. The problem I have found with an inside-out approach is that by the time the church planter has discipled his core, they have often lost contact with the community and are actually afraid of interacting with the unchurched. It's easy to get what Peter Wagner calls koinonitis, developing such a close-knit fellowship that newcomers are afraid or unable to break into it. Too often, a core group planning a new church spends so long in the small group stage that they become comfortable with it and lose their sense of mission. The fire of evangelism dies out. The problem with most small churches is that they are all core and nothing else. The same 50 people come to everything the church does. They've all been Christians for so long they have few, if any, unbelieving friends to witness to. A church with this problem needs to learn how to develop the other 4 circles. When I began Saddleback, I started by totally focusing on the community, specifically the unchurched in my community. I personally met hundreds of unchurched people by spending 12 weeks going door to door, listening to people who didn't go to church and surveying their needs. I developed relationships and built bridges of friendship with as many unbelievers as I could. I then gathered a crowd out of the community by writing a letter announcing the beginning of our church and mailing it to 15,000 homes. I wrote the letter based on what I learned about the community from my survey. We also used a lot of advertising the first year because we didn't have enough relationships to rely only on word of mouth to build a crowd. This is true of most small churches. Today, with thousands of members inviting friends to our church, advertising is unnecessary. For that first year, about all we tried to do was build a crowd and introduce them to Christ. Just as it takes an enormous amount of energy to move a rocket off a launch pad, it requires an incredible amount of effort to gather a crowd out of nothing. Our focus was very narrow. I preached very simple, straightforward evangelistic series such as Good News About Common Problems and God's Plan for Your Life. At the end of the year, we had about 200 in average attendance, and most of them were brand new believers. In our second year, I began working on turning the believers in our crowd into a congregation. We continued reaching out to the community and increasing the size of the crowd, but we added a strong emphasis on building relationships within our fellowship. We focused on converting attenders into members. I began to talk more about the value of church membership, the benefits of belonging to a church family, and the responsibilities included in membership. I preached messages with titles like, We're in this together, All in God's Family, and Why do we have a church anyway? I still remember the excitement of watching how God began transforming a crowd of self-absorbed attenders into a loving congregation of members. The third year, I instituted a plan to raise the commitment level of our members. I repeatedly challenged those in the congregation to deepen their dedication to Christ. I taught them how to establish the spiritual disciplines and habits that build spiritual maturity. I preached a series on commitment called Together We Grow, and a basic doctrine series called Questions I've Wanted to Ask God. Of course, I taught these things to new believers in the first and second years, but the third year was when it became a major emphasis. As people became solidly established in the faith, I began to give greater emphasis to involvement in ministry through messages like Every Member is a Minister, and a series called Making the Most of What God Gave You. I stressed that a non-ministering Christian was a contradiction in terms, and exploded the myth that spiritual maturity is an end in itself. I stressed that maturity is for ministry. Although we had lay ministries existing in our church from the start, we now began to organize them better into a recognizable core. I added staff to assist me in leading regular meetings for training, encouraging, and supervising the leaders of our lay ministries. Do you see the natural progression? You build a multidimensional ministry by assimilating new members in a purposeful way, focusing on one level of commitment at a time. Don't feel that you have to do everything all at once. Even Jesus didn't do everything at once. Build from the outside in. And once you've got all five groups up and running, you then continue by giving equal emphasis to each one. Some may criticize the slow speed at which we moved people to deeper levels of commitment at first, but you need to remember that we began with the hardcore unchurched and were designing an entire philosophy of ministry from scratch at the same time. I've always viewed the building of Saddleback Church as a lifetime task. My desire has been, like Paul, to lay a foundation as an expert builder, 1 Corinthians 3:10. It takes time to build commitment, to develop quality, and to move people through the circles of commitment. I can tell you how to build a balanced, healthy church, but I can't tell you how to do it quickly. Solid, stable churches are not built in a day. When God wants to make a mushroom, he takes 6 hours. When God wants to build an oak tree, he takes 60 years. Do you want your church to be a mushroom or an oak tree? 2. Program around your purposes. You need to choose or design a program to fulfill each of your purposes. Remember, each circle of commitment also corresponds to a purpose of the church. If you use the five circles as a strategy for programming, you'll identify both your targets, community, crowd, congregation, committed, and core, and your objective with each target, evangelism, worship, fellowship, discipleship, and ministry. Always clarify the purpose for every program in your church. Kill any program that doesn't fulfill a purpose. Replace a program when you find one that does a better job than the one you're using. Programs must always be the servants of your purposes. Bridge events. At Saddleback, the primary program we use to impact the community is an annual series of community-wide events. We call these our bridge events because they're designed to build a bridge between our church and our community. They are usually quite large in order to capture the attention of the entire community. These events include a harvest party as a safe alternative for children at Halloween, community-wide Christmas Eve services, community-wide Easter services, and Western Day near the 4th of July, as well as other seasonal emphases, concerts and productions. Some of our bridge events are overtly evangelistic, while others we consider pre-evangelism. They simply make the unchurched in our community aware of our church. Seeker services. The main program for the crowd is our weekend seeker services. These are designed as services to which our members can bring any unsaved friends to whom they are witnessing. The purpose of the seeker service is to assist personal evangelism, not replace it. Studies have shown that people make a decision for Christ sooner when there is group support. The main program for the congregation is our small group network. Fellowship, personal care, and a sense of belonging are all benefits of being in a small group. We tell people, you won't really feel a part of this church family until you join a small group. Life Development Institute. The main program for the committed is our Life Development Institute. The Life Development Institute offers a wide variety of opportunities for spiritual growth, Bible studies, seminars, workshops, mentoring opportunities, and independent study programs. A person may earn credits for the classes they take and eventually receive a diploma. Our midweek worship service is a vital part of the Life Development Institute. SALT. The main program for the core is our monthly SALT meeting, which stands for Saddleback Advanced Leadership Training. This two-hour rally held on the first Sunday evening of each month includes reports and testimonies from all of the lay ministries, vision casting by the pastor, skill building, leadership training, prayer, and the commissioning of new lay ministers. As a pastor, I consider my monthly meeting with the Corps of Lay Ministers to be the most important meeting I prepare for and lead. It is an invaluable opportunity to instruct, inspire, and express appreciation to the people who make Saddleback happen. The thing to remember about programming is that no single program, no matter how great it is or how well it has worked in the past, can adequately fulfill all the purposes of your church. Likewise, no single program can minister to all the people who compose each circle in your church. It takes a variety of programs to minister to the 5 levels of commitment and fulfill the 5 different purposes of the church. 3. Educate your people on purpose. Saddleback's Christian education program is purpose-driven. Our goal is to help people develop a lifestyle of evangelism, worship, fellowship, discipleship, and ministry. We want to produce doers of the Word, not hearers only, to transform, not merely inform. One of our slogans is, "You only believe the part of the Bible that you do." Transformation will not happen by chance. We must establish a disciple-making or educational process that encourages people to act on what they learn and rewards them when they do. At Saddleback, we call this the life development process. We use the simple diagram of a baseball diamond to visually explain our education and assimilation process to our members. Each base represents a completed class and a deeper level of commitment. You get to first base by completing Class 101 and committing to Saddleback's membership covenant. You arrive at second base after completing Class 201 and committing to a spiritual growth covenant. You make it to third base by completing Class 301 and committing to serve in the ministry of the church, and you finally get back to home plate by completing Class 401 and committing to sharing your faith both at home and on mission trips. These steps will be explained in detail later. As in baseball, no credit is given for runners left on base. We tell new members that our goal for them is to become Grand Slam disciples. We want them to complete all 16 hours of basic training and to commit to the covenants explained at each base. There is a written covenant at each base that we expect people to sign and commit to before moving ahead. No member may proceed to the next base until he has committed to the requirements of each covenant. Most churches do a fairly good job getting people to first base, or maybe even to second base. People will receive Christ, be baptized, and join the church. That's getting them to first base. Some churches also do an excellent job of helping believers develop the habits that lead to spiritual maturity. That's getting to second base. But few churches have a plan to ensure that every believer finds an appropriate ministry, third base, and even fewer equip members to win others to Christ and fulfill their life mission. Home plate. Our ultimate goal at Saddleback is to turn an audience into an army. You don't judge the strength of an army by how many soldiers sit and eat in the mess hall, but by how they perform on the front line. Likewise, a church's strength is not seen in how many show up for services, the crowd, but how many serve in the core. In the early 1980s, I used to joke that my objective was to turn yuppies, young urban professionals, into yummies, young urban missionaries. As I've said before, I believe the church is to be a missionary sending station. Only as we move members completely around the bases to home plate can we fulfill the Great Commission. 4. Start small groups on purpose. We don't expect each small group to do the same things. We allow them to specialize. Seeker groups. Our seeker groups are formed exclusively for evangelism. They provide a non-threatening environment for non-believers to ask questions, express doubts, and investigate the claims of Christ. Support groups. We have support groups for the purpose of congregational care, fellowship, and worship. Many of our support groups are related to providing support and fellowship during a specific stage of life, such as new parents, college students, or empty nesters. Others deal with healing specific hurts encountered by those who have lost a mate by death or divorce. We also have a full menu of recovery groups. Service groups. These groups are formed around a specific ministry, such as our orphanage in Mexico, our prison ministry, or our divorce recovery ministry. Groups such as these naturally find fellowship together through a common task, project, or ministry. Growth groups. Our growth groups are dedicated to nurturing, discipleship training, and in-depth Bible study. We offer about 50 different curriculum choices, and some of these groups do a more in-depth study of the previous week's sermon subject. Rather than force everyone to conform to a one-size-fits-all mentality, we allow people to choose the type of small group that best fits their needs, their interests, their stage of life, or their spiritual maturity. We do not expect each small group to fulfill every purpose of the church, but we do require that each one must be organized around at least one purpose of the church. 5. Add staff on purpose. Each person we hire onto our church staff is given a purpose-based job description. While interviewing, we use some standard questions in order to discover which of the church's purposes an applicant feels most passionate about, and then we place them accordingly. We don't look just for character and competence when interviewing staff. We look for a passion about one of the purposes of the church. People who are passionate about something they're doing are self-motivated. If I were starting a new church today, I would begin by recruiting 5 volunteers for 5 unpaid staff positions. A music magnification director to help prepare the worship services for the crowd, a membership director to teach class 101 and oversee the care of members in the congregation, a maturity director to teach class 201 and oversee the Bible study programs for the committed, a ministry director to teach class 301, interview people for ministry placement and supervise the lay ministries of the core, and a mission director to teach class 401 and oversee our evangelism and mission programs in the community. As the church grew, I would move these people to part-time paid staff and eventually full-time. With this plan, you can be purpose-driven regardless of the size of your church. 6. Structure on purpose. Rather than organizing by traditional departments, organize around purpose-based teams. At Saddleback, every lay ministry and every staff member is assigned to one of our 5 purpose-based teams. In turn, each team is led by a team pastor, assisted by a team coordinator, and composed of a combination of paid staff ministers and volunteer lay ministers. Together, they lead the programs, ministries, and events that fulfill the particular purpose assigned to that team. The missions team. The missions team is assigned the purpose of evangelism. Their target is the community. Their job is to plan, promote, and oversee all of the church's bridge events, seeker groups, evangelism training, including Class 401, evangelistic activities and programs, and mission projects. They are to organize whatever it takes to reach our community and our world for Christ. The church is in the sending business. It is our goal that eventually 25% of our membership will do some kind of mission project each year. I'd love to see our attendance go down every summer, not because people are on vacation, but because they're out on the mission field serving. Another goal is to send out 200 career missionaries from Saddleback in the next 20 years. This past year, we sent adult members on mission projects to 5 continents, and our youth did mission projects at our orphanage in Mexico and at a rescue mission in inner city Los Angeles. The Magnification Music Team. This team is assigned the purpose of worship. Their target is the crowd. Their job is to plan and oversee our weekend seeker services, special worship emphases and events, and to provide music and worship resources to the rest of the church. The membership team. This team is assigned the purpose of fellowship. Their target is the congregation. It is their business to care for the flock. They run our monthly class for prospective members, Class 101. They oversee all support groups, weddings, funerals, pastoral care, hospital visitation, and benevolence within the congregation, and they operate the counseling center. Finally, this team is responsible for all major fellowship events within our church family. The maturity team. The maturity team is assigned the purpose of discipleship. Their target is the committed. Their goal is to lead our members to deeper spiritual commitment and help them develop to spiritual maturity. This team operates the monthly Class 201 and is responsible for the Life Development Institute, the midweek worship service, all Bible studies, growth groups in homes, and special church-wide spiritual growth campaigns. They also produce family devotional guides, Bible study curriculums, and other resources to help believers grow. The Ministry Team. This team is assigned the purpose of ministry. Their target is the core. Their job is to turn members into ministers by helping members discover their shape for ministry and guiding them to find either an existing place for ministry or a new ministry. This team operates the Ministry Development Center and is responsible for all service groups as well as for the monthly Class 301 and SALT meetings. They also assist, train, and supervise the lay ministers of the church. The goal of this team is to help every member of the church find a meaningful place of service that best expresses his or her gifts and abilities. 7. Preach on purpose. To produce balanced, healthy believers, you need to plan a preaching schedule that includes a series on each of the 5 purposes over the course of a year. A 4-week series related to each of the 5 purposes would require only 20 weeks. There would still be more than half a year left to preach on other themes. Planning your preaching around the 5 purposes of the church does not mean you must always be teaching about the church itself. Personalize the purposes. Talk about them in terms of God's 5 purposes for every Christian. For example, here are some titles of series I've preached in which I applied the purposes in a personalized way. You Are Shaped for Significance was a series to mobilize people for ministry. The 6 Stages of Faith was a series on the circumstances God takes believers through to mature them. Learning to Hear God's Voice was a series on worship. Answering Life's Toughest Questions was a series based on Ecclesiastes to prepare people for evangelism. Building Great Relationships was a series based on 1 Corinthians 13 designed to deepen the fellowship of our church. When you use the 5 purposes of the church as a guide for planning your preaching schedule, you are preaching with a purpose. 8. Budget on purpose. We categorize every line item in our church budget by the purpose of the church that it supports or to which it relates. The quickest way to discover a church's priorities is to look at its budget and calendar. The way we spend our time and the way we spend our money show what is really important to us, regardless of what we claim to believe. If your church claims that evangelism is a priority, you need to be able to back up that claim with dollars allocated in your budget. Otherwise, you're just blowing smoke. 9. Calendar on purpose. Designate 2 months of each year to give special emphasis to each purpose. Then give each purpose team, composed of staff or volunteers, the assignment of emphasizing that purpose church-wide during those months. For example, January and June might each be maturity months. During a month-long emphasis on spiritual maturity, you might read through the New Testament as a congregation, memorize a Bible verse together each week, or hold a Bible conference or a church-wide Bible study. February and July could each be ministry months. During these months, you could hold a ministry fair to recruit people for ministry. The pastor could preach a series on ministry. People could be encouraged to join a service group. March and August might be missions month, with activities like personal evangelism training, a missions conference, and special hands-on mission projects. April and September could be membership months. These months would be good months to put a special emphasis on recruiting attenders to become new members. You could plan a number of church-wide fellowship events like picnics, concerts, and festivals. May and October could be magnification months, 2 months that emphasize personal and corporate worship. By committing 2 months a year to each of the 5 purposes, you'll be left with 2 free months. In this example, November and December, which are already busy with Thanksgiving and Christmas. Don't fool yourself. If you don't schedule your purposes on your calendar, they won't get emphasized. 10. Evaluate on purpose. To remain effective as a church in an ever-changing world, you need to continually evaluate what you do. Build review and revision into your process. Evaluate for excellence. In a purpose-driven church, your purposes are the standard by which you evaluate effectiveness. Having a purpose without any practical way to review results would be like NASA planning a moonshot without a tracking system. You'll be unable to make mid-course corrections, and will probably never hit your target. At Saddleback, we've developed a tracking tool we call the Saddleback Snapshot. Our pastoral staff reviews it each month. The snapshot is a 6-page overview of our disciple development process. It identifies who is at each base of our life development process, baseball diamond. Like the old Abbott and Costello routine, we want to know who's on first. The snapshot also shows how many people are currently in each circle of commitment and measures a number of other key indicators of church health. The snapshot forces us to take an honest look each month at how well our church is fulfilling its purposes. Bottlenecks in the system become easy to spot. For instance, if worship attendance increases 35% in a year, but membership and small group attendance only increases 20%, we know we've got to rectify some gap in the process. Statistics like this help us evaluate our assimilation process and determine where emphasis is needed. As I mentioned in an earlier chapter, we must be constantly asking, what is our business? And how's business? Growing stronger. As you seek to apply your purposes to every area of your church, you will notice the church growing stronger and stronger. Instead of constantly looking for new programs each year to keep people excited and motivated, you will be able to focus on the essentials. You will be able to learn from each mistake and build on every success. If unchanging purposes guide your church, you will be able to work on fulfilling those purposes better each passing year. Momentum works in your favor. The more your members understand and commit to your purposes, the stronger your church will become. Part 3. Reaching out to your community. 9. Who is your target? Jesus. I was sent only to the lost sheep of Israel. Matthew 15:24. Paul. I had been entrusted with the task of preaching the gospel to the Gentiles, just as Peter had been to the Jews. Galatians 2:7. I once saw a Peanuts cartoon that described the evangelistic strategy of many churches. Charlie Brown was practicing archery in his backyard. Instead of aiming at a target, he would shoot an arrow at his fence and then walk over and draw a target around wherever the arrow stuck. Lucy walked up and said, "Why are you doing this, Charlie Brown?" He replied without embarrassment, "This way I never miss." Unfortunately, the same logic is behind a lot of churches' evangelistic outreach efforts. We shoot arrows of good news into our community, and if they happen to hit anyone, we say, "That was our target all along." There is little planning or strategizing behind our efforts. We don't aim at any specific target. We just draw a bullseye around whomever we reach and settle for that. This is an incredibly callous approach to evangelism. Bringing people to Christ is too important a task for us to have such a casual attitude toward it. Too many congregations are naive in their thinking about evangelism. If you ask the members, "Who is your church trying to reach for Christ?" the response will likely be, "Everybody. We're trying to reach the entire world for Jesus Christ." Of course, this is the goal of the Great Commission, and it should be the prayer of every church. But in practice, there is not a local church anywhere that can reach everybody. Because human beings are so different, no single church can possibly reach everyone. That's why we need all kinds of churches. Together, we can accomplish what no single congregation, strategy, or style can accomplish by itself. Sit in an airport terminal for half a day, and it will become quite obvious that God loves diversity. He created an infinite variety of people with different interests, preferences, backgrounds, and personalities. To reach all of these people for Christ will require a variety of styles of evangelism. The message must stay the same, but the methods and style of communicating it will vary greatly. I always refuse to debate which method of evangelism works best. It depends on who you're trying to reach. Different kinds of bait catch different kinds of fish. I'm in favor of any method that reaches at least one person for Christ as long as it's ethical. I think it will be very embarrassing someday when critics of a particular method of evangelism get to heaven and discover all the people who are there because of it. We should never criticize any method that God is blessing. For your church to be most effective in evangelism, you must decide on a target. Discover what types of people live in your area. Decide which of those groups your church is best equipped to reach, and then discover which styles of evangelism best match your target. While your church may never be able to reach everyone, it is especially suited to reaching certain types of people. Knowing who you're trying to reach makes evangelism much easier. Imagine what would happen to a commercial radio station if it tried to appeal to everyone's taste in music. A station that alternated its format between classical, heavy metal, country, rap, reggae, and southern gospel would end up alienating everyone. No one would listen to that station. Successful radio stations select a target audience. They research their broadcast area, figure out which segments of the population are not being reached by other stations, and then choose a format that reaches their target. Defining our evangelistic target has been the second most important factor behind Saddleback's growth. After figuring out who our church was best capable of reaching for Jesus Christ, we intentionally went after those people. When we plan an evangelistic effort, we always have a specific target in mind. The Bible determines our message, but our target determines when, where, and how we communicate it. It is imperative that you not even think about who your target may be until after you've clarified the purposes of your church. The biblical foundation must be laid first. I've watched some churches develop their evangelism strategy, beginning with their target, without laying the foundation of God's eternal purposes. The result was an unstable and unbiblical church, driven by market forces rather than the Word of God. The message must never be compromised. Targeting for evangelism is biblical. The practice of targeting specific kinds of people for evangelism is a biblical principle for ministry. It's as old as the New Testament. Jesus targeted his ministry. When a Canaanite woman asked Jesus to minister to her demon-possessed daughter, he publicly stated that the Father had told him to focus on the lost sheep of Israel. See Matthew 15, verses 22 through 28. Although Jesus went ahead and healed the Canaanite woman's daughter because of her faith, he publicly identified his ministry target as the Jews. Was Jesus being unfair or prejudiced? Certainly not. Jesus targeted his ministry in order to be effective, not to be exclusive. Earlier, Jesus had instructed the disciples to target their ministry also. Matthew 10, 5 and 6 says, "These 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions. Do not go among the Gentiles or enter any town of the Samaritans. Go rather to the lost sheep of Israel." Paul targeted his ministry to Gentiles, and Peter targeted his ministry to Jews. Galatians 2, 7. Both ministries were needed. Both were important. Both were effective. Even the Gospels were written with specific target audiences in mind. Have you ever considered why God used 4 writers and 4 books to communicate the one life of Christ? After almost all of the stories and teaching in the Gospel of Mark are covered in the Gospel of Matthew. Why do we need both books? Because Matthew's Gospel was targeted for the Hebrew reader and Mark's was targeted for the Gentile reader. They had the same message, but because they wrote for different audiences, their style of communication differed. Targeting your audience for evangelism is a method God invented. He expects us to witness to people in their own terms. The concept of evangelistic targeting is built into the Great Commission. We are to make disciples of all nations. The Greek term, ta ethne, from which we derive the word ethnic, refers literally to all people groups. Each of these unique people groups needs an evangelistic strategy that communicates the gospel in terms that their specific culture can understand. In March of 1995, Billy Graham's Puerto Rico crusade was broadcast simultaneously in 116 languages to audiences around the world. The message was the same, but it was translated into each country's language, and culturally appropriate music and testimonies were dubbed into the broadcast. Over 1 billion people heard the gospel in languages, music, and testimonies that matched their particular group. It was history's greatest example of targeted evangelism. The practice of evangelistic targeting is especially important to small churches. In a small church with limited resources, it is vital that you make the most of what you've got. Focus your resources on reaching the people your church can best communicate with. Small churches must also make choices on tough issues. For example, since it's impossible to appeal to everyone's taste in music style in a single service, and small churches can't offer multiple services, they must choose a target. Changing styles on alternate weeks will produce the same effect as a radio station with a mixed format. No one will be happy. One of the advantages of being a large church is that you have the resources to go after multiple targets. The larger your church becomes, the more you'll be able to offer choices in programs, events, and even worship styles. When Saddleback began, we focused only on one target: young, unchurched, white-collar couples. We focused on them because they were the largest group in the Saddleback Valley and because that was who I related to best. But as our church has grown, we've been able to add additional ministries and outreach programs to reach young adults, single adults, prisoners, the elderly, parents with ADD children, and Spanish, Vietnamese, and Korean-speaking people, as well as many other targets. How do you define your target? Targeting for evangelism begins with finding out all you can about your community. Your church needs to define its target in four specific ways: geographically, demographically, culturally, and spiritually. When I took hermeneutics and preaching classes in seminary, I was taught that to understand the message of the New Testament, I had to first understand the geography, customs, culture, and religion of the people who lived at that time. I could then extract the timeless, eternal truth of God from that context. This process is called exegesis. Every biblical preacher uses it. Unfortunately, no class taught me that before I communicate that timeless truth to people today, I need to exegete my own community. I must pay as much attention to the geography, customs, culture, and religious background of my community as I do to those who lived in Bible times if I'm to faithfully communicate God's Word. Define your target geographically. Jesus had a plan to evangelize the world. In Acts 1:8, he identified four geographic targets for the disciples. "But you will receive power when the Holy Spirit comes on you, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the ends of the earth." Many Bible scholars point out that this is the exact pattern of growth described in the rest of the book of Acts. The message was taken first to the Jews in Jerusalem, then to Judea, then to Samaria, and eventually it spread across Europe. In your ministry, geographic targeting simply means you identify where the people live that you want to reach. Get a map of your city or area and mark where your church is located. Estimate a 15 to 20-minute drive in each direction from your church and mark those as borders of your primary ministry area. This is your evangelistic fishing pond. Using the zip codes included in your boundaries, your county government can tell you exactly how many people live within a reasonable driving distance of your church. When determining your geographic target, there are several factors to keep in mind. First, reasonable driving distance is a highly subjective term. The average trip time in a community varies greatly depending on what part of the country you're talking about. Rural residents are willing to drive farther than urban dwellers. People are more likely to travel farther on a freeway than through miles of city stoplights. My best guess is that most people will tolerate about a dozen stoplights at the most when driving to church. Second, people choose churches today primarily on the basis of relationships and programs, not location. Just because your church is closest to someone doesn't mean you can automatically reach them. Your church may not fit them. On the other hand, there are people who will drive past 15 other churches to attend yours if it meets their needs. Third, the larger your church grows, the farther its reach will extend. We have people who drive over an hour to attend Saddleback because we offer a program or support group they can't find anywhere closer to them. As a rule, people are willing to drive farther to attend a large church with a multifaceted ministry than a smaller church with a limited ministry. Another way to map your ministry target area is to draw a circle around your church representing 5 miles. Then, find out how many people live in that circle. This is your initial ministry area. Approximately 65% of America is unchurched, and that percentage is much higher in many areas, particularly in the West and Northeast and in urban areas. If you calculate the population of your ministry area and then figure what 65% of that number is, you'll see that truly, the fields are ready for harvest. Once you've defined your geographic target, you'll know how many people are in your fishing pond. This is very important, since the population of your area is a major factor in determining what strategy you use to bring them in. In a large population center, it is possible to focus on only one segment and still grow a large church. In a smaller population area, you'd have to develop outreaches to several different segments to grow a large church. It's foolish to ignore the role of population in predicting how large a church will grow. No matter how dedicated a church is, if the ministry area only has 1,000 people in it, the church will never be large. It's not the pastor's fault, nor is it a lack of commitment on the part of the congregation. It's simple arithmetic. I've visited some large churches in metropolitan areas that have chosen a highly specialized strategy that may only reach 0.5% of the population. But because 200,000 people live in the area, the church has 1,000 in attendance. You'd be mistaken and disappointed if you thought that by imitating their same strategy, your small-town church would grow to the same size. To be realistic, you need to focus on the percentage of population being reached, not the actual numbers. A strategy that reaches 1,000 in a city of 200,000 is likely to reach 50 in a town of 1,000. It is both unwise and unhelpful to compare attendance between churches. Every church has a unique fishing pond, and each pond is stocked with a different number and type of fish. It's like comparing tangerines and submarines. Two churches may sound a lot alike, but on a closer look, their differences will be obvious. Define your target demographically. Not only do you need to find out how many people live in your area, you need to know what type of people live there. First, let me warn you, don't overdo demographic research. You can waste a lot of time collecting facts and information about your community that won't make any real difference to your church. I've known some church planters who spent months preparing beautiful binders full of demographic information on their areas. All of it was interesting, but much of it was not that useful for their church's purposes. There are only a handful of relevant demographic facts that you need to discover about the people in your community. I consider the most important factors in targeting a community for evangelism to be age, how many are in each age group, marital status, how many are single adults, how many are married couples, income, what is both the median and the average household income, education, what is the education level of the community, occupation, what types of work are predominant. Each of these factors will influence how you minister to people and how you communicate the good news. Young adults, for example, have different hopes and fears than retirees. A gospel presentation that emphasizes the assurance of heaven as the benefit of salvation will probably be ineffective in ministering to a young adult who thinks he has his entire life in front of him. He's not interested in the afterlife. He's consumed with finding out if there is any meaning or purpose to this life. One national survey showed that less than 1% of Americans were interested in the answer to the question, "How can I get to heaven?" A more effective way to witness to a young adult would be to show how we were made to have fellowship with God now through Christ. On the other hand, many elderly have a very great interest in being prepared for eternity because they know their time on earth may be up at any moment. Married couples have different interests than single adults. The poor face different problems than the middle class. The wealthy have their own set of worries. College graduates tend to see the world differently than high school graduates. It is important to know the perspective of those you are seeking to win to Christ. If you are serious about having your church make an impact, become an expert on your community. Pastors should know more about their communities than anyone else. As I explained in Chapter 1, before moving to my community, I spent 3 months studying census statistics and demographic studies so I could determine what kinds of people lived in the Saddleback Valley. Before I set foot there, I knew how many people lived there, where they worked, how much they earned, their educational level, and much more. Where can you get this kind of information? There are a number of resources, including the U.S. Census Library, county or city planning departments, newspaper offices, the local chamber of commerce, the United Way, local contractors, realtors, and utility companies. Most large denominations also maintain demographic databases you can access. Define your target culturally. Understanding the demographics of your community is important, but understanding the culture of your community is even more important. This is something you won't find in census statistics. I use the word culture to refer to the lifestyle and mindset of those who live around your church. The business world uses the term psychographics, which is just a fancy way of referring to people's values, interests, hurts, and fears. Long before businesses became enamored with psychographics, Christian missionaries were identifying the differences between cultures. No missionary to a foreign land would try to evangelize and minister to people without first understanding their culture. It would be foolish to do so. In today's secular environment, it is just as important for us to understand the culture we minister in. We don't have to agree with our culture, but we must understand it. Within your community, there are most likely many subcultures or subgroups. To reach each of these groups, you need to discover how they think. What are their interests? What do they value? Where do they hurt? What are they afraid of? What are the most prominent features of the way they live? What are their most popular radio stations? The more you know about these people, the easier it will be to reach them. One of the major barriers to church growth is people blindness, being unaware of social and cultural differences between people. Are all white people alike? Of course they aren't. Are all black people alike? Of course not. Are all Hispanics or Asians alike? No. A trained eye will pick up on important distinctions between people who live in your area. The best way to find out the culture, mindset, and lifestyle of people is to talk to them personally. You don't need to hire a marketing firm. Just go out and meet with the people in your community face to face. Take your own survey. Ask them what they feel are their greatest needs. Listen for their hurts, interests, and fears. No book or demographic report can replace actually talking with the people in your community. Statistics paint only a part of the picture. You must personally spend time with people, getting a feel for your community through one-on-one interaction. I believe there is no substitute for this. Define your target spiritually. After you have defined your target area culturally, you need to discover the spiritual background of the people in your community. Determine what those in your target area already know about the gospel. For instance, when I studied the Saddleback Valley, I discovered that 94% of Orange County residents believed in God or a universal spirit. 75% believed in the biblical definition of God. 70% believed in life after death, and 52% believed they were here on earth for a spiritual purpose. This was very helpful in knowing where to start with people when witnessing to them. In order to determine a community's spiritual climate, you might interview other pastors in the area. Pastors who have served a dozen years in a community should be very aware of that area's local issues and spiritual trends. Before I moved to California to start our church, I contacted each of the evangelical pastors in the Saddleback Valley to hear their assessment of the valley's spiritual needs. The task was surprisingly simple. I went to the city library, found a Yellow Pages directory for Orange County, California, looked up churches, and wrote down the names and addresses of all the evangelical congregations in the Saddleback Valley. Then, I wrote a letter to each pastor explaining what I was doing and asked him to answer 6 questions on an enclosed, stamped reply card. I got about 30 cards back. I gained some great insight and began some wonderful long-term friendships with many of those pastors. A few years ago, I read about a study done by New York University on the religious life of Americans. The study reported that 90% of all Americans claim some kind of religious affiliation. While that doesn't mean that they are actively practicing their faith, it does mean that almost every American has had some kind of contact with a religious organization in the past. The term unchurched doesn't refer to only people who have never been inside a church. It also includes those who have a church background but no personal relationship to Christ, and those who haven't been in church for some time, usually years. 26% of Americans claim a Catholic background. If you live on the West Coast, your number one prospect is probably a former Catholic. If you live in the South, your largest pool of prospects will definitely be those claiming a Baptist background, 30%. In North Dakota, the odds are that the unchurched person you talk to has a Lutheran background, 28%. And in Kansas or Iowa, he or she is likely to have a Methodist background, 13%. In Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah, expect a Mormon background. You need to know your area. Whenever I witness to someone who doesn't have a relationship to Christ, I try to discover any common ground we may have due to their religious background. For example, when I talk with a Catholic, I know they accept the Bible but have probably never read it, and that they accept the Trinity, the virgin birth, and Jesus Christ as the Son of God. We already have basic agreement on some major issues. My job, then, becomes communicating the difference between having a religion based on works and having a relationship to Christ based on grace. When I speak at pastors' conferences, I will often have pastors tell me that their church is just like Saddleback. When I ask what they mean by that, they respond, "Well, we're focused on reaching the unchurched." I say, "That's wonderful. What kind of unchurched are you reaching?" After all, the unchurched are not all alike. To say that your target is the unchurched is an incomplete description. Unchurched intellectuals in Berkeley are very different from farmers in Fresno or unchurched immigrants in Los Angeles. Defining your church's evangelistic target takes time and serious study. But once you've completed your research, you'll understand why some evangelistic methods work in your area and why others don't. It can spare you from wasting valuable effort and money on evangelistic approaches that won't work. In the early 1980s, some churches tried using telemarketing as a tool for evangelism. Saddleback never jumped on the bandwagon. Why? Because in our targeting surveys, we'd already discovered two things. First, we knew that the number one personal annoyance of Orange County residents was strangers who called to sell me something on the telephone. Second, we knew that more than half of our community had unlisted phone numbers. That settled that. It is amazing to me that churches often spend thousands of dollars on evangelistic projects without first asking the people they intend to reach if they think the program will work. Personalize your target. Once you've collected all the information on your community, I encourage you to create a composite profile of the typical unchurched person your church wants to reach. Combining the characteristics of residents in your area into a single mythical person will make it easier for members of your church to understand who your target is. If you've done a good job at collecting information, your members should recognize this mythical person as their next-door neighbor. At Saddleback, we've named our composite profile Saddleback Sam. Most of our members would have no problem describing Sam. We discuss him in detail in every membership class. Saddleback Sam is the typical unchurched man who lives in our area. His age is late 30s or early 40s. He has a college degree and may have an advanced degree. The Saddleback Valley has one of the highest household education levels in America. He is married to Saddleback Samantha. They have two kids, Steve and Sally. Surveys show that Sam likes his job, he likes where he lives, and he thinks he's enjoying life now more than he was 5 years ago. He's self-satisfied, even smug, about his station in life. He's either a professional, a manager, or a successful entrepreneur. Sam is among the most affluent of Americans, but he carries a lot of debt, especially due to the price of his home. Health and fitness are high priorities for Sam and his family. You can usually see Sam jogging each morning, and Samantha attends an aerobics class 3 times a week at the Family Fitness Center. Both of them like to listen to contemporary pop and country music, especially when they're working out. When it comes to socializing, Sam and his wife would rather be in a large group than a small one. Why? In a crowd, Sam can hide and maintain the anonymity and privacy that he jealously guards. Sam has an unlisted phone number and may live in a gated community. This was the main reason we used direct mail advertising in the first years of Saddleback. It was the only way to contact many of the homes in our area. Another important characteristic of Sam's is that he's skeptical of what he calls organized religion. He's likely to say, "I believe in Jesus, I just don't like organized religion." We like to counter this by joking, "Then you will like Saddleback. We're disorganized religion." Sam, because he is a Southern Californian, prefers casual, informal meetings over anything stiff and formal. He loves to dress down for the mild Southern California climate. We take this into account when planning services to attract Sam. For example, I never wear a coat and tie when I speak at Saddleback services. I intentionally dress down to match the mindset of those I'm trying to reach. I follow Paul's strategy given in 1 Corinthians 9:20. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. In my situation, I'm sure Paul would say, when in Southern California, I became like a Southern Californian in order to win Southern Californians. I don't think how people dressed mattered a lot to Jesus. We'd rather have a pagan come to church in tennis shoes and shorts than not come because he doesn't own a suit. Saddleback Sam is also overextended in time and money. His credit card is used to the limit. He is very materialistic and yet will honestly admit that his wealth has not brought him lasting happiness. Why do we go to all this trouble defining the typical person we're trying to reach? Because the more you understand someone, the easier it is to communicate with him. If you were to create a profile of the typical resident in your area, what characteristics would you give him? What would you name him? It's worth thinking about. Once you've defined and named your church's evangelistic target, do me a favor. Send me a copy. I have a hobby of collecting church evangelistic profiles. I have a file filled with characters like Dallas Doug, Memphis Mike, and Atlanta Al. Can you imagine a photographer shooting pictures without taking the time to focus? What deer hunter would stand on top of a hill and shoot randomly into the valley without taking aim at something? Without a target, our efforts at evangelism are often only wishful thinking. Of course, it takes time to focus and aim, but it also pays off. The more your target is in focus, the more likely it is that you'll be able to hit it. Ten. Knowing whom you can best reach. The first thing Andrew did was to find his brother Simon and tell him, "We have found the Messiah," John 1:41. While Jesus was having dinner at Matthew's house, many tax collectors and sinners came and ate with him and his disciples. Matthew 9:10. Even a casual reading of the New Testament will show that the gospel spread primarily through relationships. As soon as Andrew heard about Christ, he went and told his brother Simon Peter. Philip immediately contacted a friend, Nathanael. Matthew, a tax collector, held an evangelistic dinner party for other tax collectors. The woman at the well told everyone in her village about Christ. The list goes on and on. I believe that the most effective evangelistic strategy is to first try to reach those with whom you already have something in common. After you've discovered all the possible target groups in your community, which group should you focus on first? The answer is to go after those you are most likely to reach. As we've already discussed, every church is best suited to reach certain types of people. Your church will have an easier time reaching some kinds of people and more difficulty reaching other kinds of people. And there are some types of people your church will never reach because they require a completely different style of ministry than you can provide. Many factors cause people to be resistant to attending your church. Theological barriers, relational barriers, emotional barriers, lifestyle barriers, and cultural barriers. Although the first four barriers are very real, in this chapter I would like to focus on the cultural barrier. The people your church is most likely to reach are those who match the existing culture of your church. Who already attends our church? How do you determine your church's culture? Ask yourself, what kind of people already attend our church? This may discourage some pastors, but it is the truth. Whatever type of people you already have in your congregation is the same type you are likely to attract more of. It is unlikely that your church will attract and keep many people who are very different from those who already attend. When visitors walk into your church, the first question they ask isn't a religious question but a cultural one. As their eyes scan the room full of strange faces, they are unconsciously asking, "Is there anybody here like me?" A visiting retired couple looks to see if there are any other older folks present in the congregation. A serviceman looks for anyone else wearing a uniform or who has a military haircut. Young couples with infants immediately scan the crowd to see if there are other young couples with babies or small children. If visitors find other people in your church that seem similar to them, they are much more likely to come back again. What is the likelihood of a church full of retirees reaching teenagers? Not likely. How about the likelihood of a church made up of military personnel reaching peace activists? Highly unlikely. Or what's the likelihood of a church composed primarily of blue-collar factory workers reaching white-collar executives? It's possible, but don't bet on it. Of course, as believers, we must want and welcome all people into our church family. After all, we are all the same in the eyes of God. But remember, the fact that a church may be unsuccessful in reaching certain types of people isn't a matter of right or wrong, but a matter of simply respecting the wonderful variety of people God has placed in the world. What kind of leaders do we have? The second question to ask when figuring out who your church can best reach is, what is the cultural background and personality of our church's leadership? The personal characteristics of your leadership, both paid staff and lay leaders, have enormous impact on your church's ministry. Leaders cast long shadows. Many studies have shown that the number one reason people choose a church is because they identify with the pastor. Now, don't misunderstand this. The pastor does not attract first-time visitors, but he is a major reason visitors come back or don't. When visitors identify with the pastor, they are far more likely to return. If you are a pastor, you must honestly ask yourself, what kind of person am I? What is my cultural background? What kind of people do I naturally relate to, and what kind do I have a harder time understanding? You need to do a frank analysis of who you are and the type of people to whom you relate best. While I was a college student, I served as an interim pastor in a small church made up almost entirely of truck drivers and mechanics. Since I have absolutely no background or ability with mechanical things, I had difficulty holding an intelligent conversation with many of the members. Even though I dearly loved those folks, I was a fish out of water, and they knew it. They were very polite to this young preacher, but I wasn't at all what that church needed. They needed a leader that matched who they were. On the other hand, I feel right at home with entrepreneurial businessmen, managers, and professionals. In fact, I've noticed that they're attracted to my ministry. It's nothing I planned. It's just the way God wired me. I deeply believe that God has uniquely called and shaped each of us in different ways to reach different types of people. You can reach people that I will never be able to reach for Christ, and I can probably reach some whom you can't relate to. That's why we're all needed in the body of Christ. If God has called you to ministry, then who and what you are must also be a part of that plan. You don't minister in spite of yourself, but through the personality God gave you. You were shaped by God for a purpose. If He has called you to be a pastor, that means there must be people somewhere in the world whom you can reach better than anyone else. There are two principles to remember when seeking to discern God's direction for your ministry. You'll best reach those you relate to. The easiest people for you to reach for Christ are those who are most like you. This is not to say you can't reach people unlike yourself. Of course you can. It's just harder. Some pastors relate best to highly educated intellectuals, and other pastors relate better to simple, common folk. Both groups need Christ, and both need a pastor who understands them and loves being with them. Your greatest contribution will occur when you match your target. Then you can have an impact by being yourself. Second, as a leader, you'll attract who you are, not who you want. When I started Saddleback Church, I was 26 years old. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't get anyone over 45 to join our church. The congregation pretty much matched my age group. It wasn't until I added staff who were older than I was that we began to reach senior adults. Now, as I enter middle age, I'm having to add younger staff to relate to those younger than I am. Sometimes, because pastors want to reach a certain target group, they aren't realistic about who they are. I knew a pastor in his 50s with a farming background who decided to start a church to reach baby busters because he'd seen another church do it and it looked exciting. The church failed miserably. He later confided, "I just couldn't connect on their wavelength." An exception to these two principles occurs if you've been given what I call the missionary gift. The ability to minister cross-culturally requires a special gift, an ability from the Holy Spirit to be able to communicate to people with backgrounds very different from your own. The Apostle Paul obviously had the missionary gift. His upbringing made him a Hebrew of Hebrews. See Philippians 3:5. Yet God called him to plant Gentile churches. I know some pastors who were raised in rural areas but minister very effectively in the inner city. I've also seen some southern-born pastors who have been greatly used by God in northeastern cities. But these gifted pastors are the exception to the rule. Explosive growth occurs when the type of people in the community match the type of people that are already in the church, and they both match the type of person the pastor is. But if the members and the pastor don't match, there will probably be just an explosion without the growth. Many church conflicts are caused by mismatched leaders. Placing the wrong type of leader in a church is like mismatching jumper cables on a car battery. Sparks are guaranteed to fly. There have been many times I've seen pastors who are having a hard time ministering to people in their communities because they don't match them culturally. The problem is not dedication, but background. A godly man in the wrong place will still produce only mediocre results. Personally, I have no doubt that there are many parts of our country where I would completely fail as a pastor because I'd never match the culture. God made me to minister exactly where I am. The changed lives in our church family prove it. Sometimes the wisest thing a pastor can do is to admit that he doesn't match the church or community and move somewhere else. A number of years ago, Saddleback started a new church in nearby Irvine, California. A friend of mine moved from Atlanta to pastor it. He had started a church in Atlanta that had grown to over 200 in attendance, so I knew he had the gifts needed to be a church planter. After about 8 months, the new church in Irvine had still not gotten off the ground. I asked John what he thought the problem was. He said, "It's obvious. I don't fit here. This area of Irvine is composed of wealthy, middle-aged couples with teenagers." I then asked him, "Who do you think you could best reach?" John replied, "I feel I can reach young couples with preschoolers and young single adults who are out on their own for the first time. I understand their problems." "Then we need to move you to a section of Huntington Beach," I said. We moved John to Huntington Beach, started over with a new church, and within a year, his church was running over 200 in attendance. I have another friend who pastors an African-American congregation in Long Beach, California. He came to see me one day very discouraged by the lack of growth in his church. I soon discovered that he didn't fit the educational level of his congregation. He had several advanced degrees and a very sophisticated vocabulary, but most of those in his church and community were barely high school graduates. His speaking style was turning people off. After discovering that there was an entire community of professional African-Americans living about 4 miles away, I suggested that he resign from his current pastorate and start a church in that part of Long Beach. He did exactly that, and 2 years later reported back that the new church had over 300 attending each Sunday. If you are a pastor struggling with a ministry misfit and you don't match your area, you know exactly what I've been describing. You've probably had a gut feeling about it all along. Don't feel bad. It's not a sin that you don't fit a particular area. Just move. If God has gifted you and called you into ministry, He has a place that's just right for you. What if our church doesn't match our community? Often communities change, but the makeup of a church doesn't. What do you do if you're serving in a church that doesn't match the community? Build on your strengths. Don't try to be something you're not. If your church is primarily made up of elderly folks, decide to become the most effective ministry to senior citizens that you can possibly be. Don't try to become a baby buster congregation. Strengthen what you're already doing and don't worry about what you can't do. Keep doing what you've been strong at. Just do it better. Chances are that there's a pocket of people in your community that only your church can reach. Reinvent your congregation. Reinventing the congregation is when you intentionally change the makeup of your church in order to match a new target. You completely replace all the old programs, structures, and worship styles with new ones. I want this to be very clear. I do not advise this. It is a painful process and may take many years. People will leave the church due to the enormous inevitable conflicts. If you lead this process, you will probably be vilified as Satan incarnate by older members unless you've been there longer than everyone else. I've seen this done successfully, but not without an enormous amount of persistence and willingness to absorb criticism. It takes a very loving, patient, and gifted pastor to lead a church in reinventing itself. Don't even consider this option in a church with over 100 attenders unless God tells you to. It is a road to martyrdom. However, if you are in a church of 50 people or less, this may be a viable option for you. One advantage for the small church is that it can be completely transformed by having just a few families leave and a few new families join. But the bigger a church gets, the less likely you'll be able to do this. Start new congregations. This third option is the one I love to recommend. There are a couple of ways to start a new congregation to reach a new target in your community. First, you can add another worship service with a different worship style in order to reach people that are not being reached by the current style of your worship service. All across America, churches are beginning second and even third worship services in order to offer options and increase their outreach. A second approach is to actually begin a mission, which you intend to become a self-supporting congregation. Starting new congregations is the fastest way to fulfill the Great Commission. You may remember being taught in your high school biology class that the primary characteristic of biological maturity is the ability to reproduce. I believe the same is true for the church, which the Bible refers to as a body. The mark of a truly mature church is that it has babies. It starts other churches. You do not have to be a large church to start new congregations. Saddleback Church started our first daughter church when our church was just a year old. Each year since then, we've started at least one new daughter church. As I mentioned in the last chapter, by our 15th anniversary, we had started 25 other churches. Recognizing spiritual receptivity in your community. Jesus taught in the parable of the sower and the soils, see Matthew 13, verses 3 through 23, that spiritual receptivity varies widely. Like different kinds of soil, people respond differently to the good news. Some people are very open to hearing the gospel, and others are very closed. In the parable of the sower, Jesus explained that there are hard hearts, shallow hearts, distracted hearts, and receptive hearts. For evangelism to have maximum effectiveness, we need to plant our seed in the good soil, the soil that produces a hundredfold harvest. No farmer in his right mind would waste seed, a precious commodity, on infertile ground that won't produce a crop. In the same way, careless, unplanned broadcasting of the gospel is poor stewardship. The message of Christ is too important to waste time, money, and energy on non-productive methods and soil. We need to be strategic in reaching the world, focusing our efforts where they will make the greatest difference. Even within your church's target group, there will be various pockets of receptivity. Spiritual receptivity is something that comes and goes in people's lives like an ocean tide. At various times in life, people tend to be more open to spiritual truth than at other times. God uses a variety of tools to soften hearts and prepare people to be saved. Who are the most receptive people? I believe there are two broad categories: people in transition and people under tension. God uses both change and pain to get people's attention and make them receptive to the gospel.